wherever you were. You were here, I'm sure, you know, in Manhattan, some of you.
Welcome back. Welcome back. Once Thanksgiving comes, Hanukkah can't be far behind. Obviously. So, 2 weeks from tonight, we will, at the conclusion of our class, have our annual Hanukkah party, which is a long-standing tradition of the Talmud class. It makes the holiday and is always a joy. And so I hope that you will especially plan to be here. We'll light the candles at the beginning of the class, and then we'll light the rest of us at the end of the class.
Well, everyone, no fantasy, same menu.
Same menu.
We always have scotch.
Scotch, halva.
What kind of scotch?
Jay buys scotch, I buy the halva.
You talk to Jay if you're interested in the scotch menu. But I tell you, Jay knows what he's doing, so you've got to... No Hanukkah gelt? Talk to these people.
You can bring Hanukkah gelt.
Okay. Excellent. I just read a story about Hanukkah gelt. Did you read that in the last day or two? It was a report in either the Wall Street Journal or one of the things that I read. It was about Hanukkah gelt, updated Hanukkah gelt. Hanukkah gelt for adults, it was called. It was in the food section of the Times? Oh. Well, I read it. I just don't remember where it's from. Today was the food section. But it was cool. If you can get a hold of that, that'd be interesting. Because it was based on the... Really? I'll go check it out on the internet. You never know. Hopefully it is. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we are on Daf Lamed Zayin Amud Aleph, page 37A3. We have been discussing, just to review where we have been in the fourth chapter. We began the chapter by saying there is a similarity between the law of the laws concerning monetary matters and the criminal law. And that similarity was that there is Rishon Chakira, that in the procedure of both cases, both in the area of monetary law and in criminal law, there will be Drishan Chakira, that is, the witnesses will always be questioned. There will be a cross-examination as part of the procedure that is appropriate. And then immediately the Mishnah went and said, but there are differences between monetary law and the criminal law. And we saw, for example, that monetary law was dealt with in a court of 3, and criminal law was dealt with in a court of 23. Okay? The next Mishnah spoke to the court of 23, and we saw there were procedures in the court of 23 about how the court would sit. That it sits in a semicircle. Okay? That wouldn't have been relevant to the court of 3. It is by the time you get to the court of 23. And then the last thing we read about in the Mishnah was that there was actually a procedure for moving up if for some reason a judge was no longer able to participate in the adjudication. Then in fact we saw that there was a whole process of musical chairs and you moved up according to that. Now we come to the third Mishnah, and that is the Mishnah of Ketzad Me'ayinim Et Ha'Edim. We are still in the court, which is a court trying a criminal case. It is therefore the court of 23. And immediately the Mishnah shifts gears to ask, Ketzad Me'ayinim Et Ha'Edim Al Edei Nefashot? What is the procedure? In what way does one, here the English translation is admonish. It's not a bad word. I would translate it a little bit more freely as terrify. How do you terrify the witnesses? How do you scare the witnesses? Okay? Because le'ayin is to make somebody scared. It's to terrify. Right? How do you terrify the witnesses al edei nefashot when they are witnesses in a capital crime, in a capital case? Okay? So we know what we're talking about here. We're talking about a capital case, and there apparently is something that will happen between the judges and the witnesses. The judges will address the witnesses. Here we see. Hayu machnisim otan umayimim aleihem. They would bring them together. They would bring them in. Umayimim aleihem, and cause them to be scared. In other words, address them in such a way that we make very clear to them what the impact is of the judgment that they are going to render, of the testimony that they are going to give. It's a scary thing because this is a capital case. And as a result of their testimony, somebody could lose their life. And so they have to take that fact very seriously. No. Shema Tomru, we got to get going a little bit. Shema Tomru, me omed ushmua, umipi adam nem, aid mipi aid, umipi adam nem. So first, they would say to them, perhaps you are going to say what you're going to say, me omed, based on conjecture. In other words, you know part of what happened. But from what you know, your mind immediately goes to assume other things. And therefore, as a result of partial knowledge, you are going to claim more knowledge than you actually have. That's omit. Omit is when you estimate something. Right? So in other words, you go into a situation, you see something, and we'll see a little further on when we get to the Gemara, an example of this, that a person, well, I won't tell you what it is. You'll see when you get to the Gemara, because it's a nice story. The Gemara illustrates this. But, so it's only partial knowledge, and you're claiming more knowledge than you actually have. Perhaps you're going to do that. Or, Mishmua. Maybe you are going to testify as a result of hearsay. You heard somebody describe what happened, and it was perfectly reasonable what they said. And therefore, you are going to report it as if you had seen it yourself. Okay? And that can happen. It can happen. It's very easy to convince yourself that you actually saw something that you didn't necessarily see. Now, why is this crucial? Because, in fact, the Torah says that you have to be a witness to the action. Okay? The Torah will actually say that you must have witnessed the action. Now, when it says that you've been a witness to the action, what does it mean? It means you've been a witness to the action. So you have to both be a witness, and you have to have seen the action. Okay? In our language, we would say, can you convict on the basis of circumstantial evidence? In this system, you can't. Circumstantial evidence is not enough to convict in a capital case. You actually must have a witness who has seen the thing happen for which the person is going to be punished. So circumstantial evidence is not ultimately admissible for this purpose. That would be omit, would be circumstantial evidence. Okay, in your estimation, right? Okay. Aid me pi aid. Perhaps there has been one witness and another witness hears it from that witness. Right, so in other words, you didn't see it directly, but you heard somebody who did see it directly. And you're reporting on the basis of what they said. And it says, umipi adam ne'emar. Could be that this umipi doesn't add another possibility, but it sort of clarifies the previous statement. If you hear one witness from another, and that witness is an ed ne'emar, it's somebody who is completely trustworthy. Right? There are plenty of people who you have no question about whether you trust. They say they saw it. You hear it from them. And so you testify that it's true. You testify that it's true. That, none of that is admissible. None of that is admissible because you must have seen the thing yourself. Shema I atem yodim shesofenu libdok etchem bidrisha ubachakira. Next thing that the judge says, the dayanim, whoever is doing this, addressing of the witness says, perhaps you don't know that you will be checked, bidrisha v'chakira, through cross-examination. You know, maybe you're not aware of the fact that we are going to try and make sure that everything that you are saying is exactly as you said it. And you are going to be challenged in terms of what you are testifying. So you say to him, yeah, maybe you don't know that before you get started. You know, and we want you to be aware of this fact, because perhaps you're not aware. You're not aware of it. Havu yodim shalo bidine mamonot dine nefashot. Know that capital cases are not like monetary cases. Here, what the Mishnah is doing, sort of beautiful literary echo of the first Mishnah, because the first Mishnah said monetary cases and capital cases are alike. And then it says, but they are different. And here, now you finally realize why the first Mishnah was constructed the way it was, to say that they were alike. In fact, all of that was a setup. It was a setup, and we said that by the time we got into the Mishnah quickly went from the one thing that they were alike to the many ways that they're different. And here, of course, Drishan Hakira, the cross-examination, was the way that they were alike. So lest you think that Dine Mamonot, the law, monetary law, is the same as capital law. Viodim shelo kedine mamonot dine nefashot. Know that the capital law in a criminal case that could lead to a capital crime, is not the same as law that relates to monetary cases. Dine mamonot adam notein mamonu mitkaper lo. In monetary law, if a person pays, what he is required to pay, mitkaperlo, then he has atoned. That is a proper atonement, and he doesn't carry with him any burden after he does that. Okay? Dine nefashot, damo v'dam zarotav tluyim bo. His blood and the blood of his progeny are literally leaning on him. They're attached to him. Ab sof ha'olam, to the end of the world. In other words, if we are going to kill this person, we're going to kill the whole world. Because from one person can come an entire world of people. Just think of the ramifications of what you are doing. All of the generations, forever and ever, will never be because of your actions.
Unless he has kids before.
Okay. Unless, maybe, but you don't know. You don't know what happens. You don't know what happens. Look at the example here. Shekein Matsinu Bekain Sharaget Achiv. For so we have found with Cain, who murdered his brother. Shineamar, as it says, Dnei Achicha Tzoikim Elai Min Adama. The Torah says, Kol Dnei Achicha Tzoikim Elai Min Adama. God says to Cain, Kol, the voice, Dnei Achicha, of your brother's bloods, So Akim Elai Mina Adama are crying out to me from the earth. You know, when he says, where is your brother Hevel, Abel? God says after Cain has killed Abel. And Cain says, don't know. Don't know. And then God says, Kol Dnei Achicha Tzoakim Elai Mina Adama. The voice of your brother's bloods are crying out to me from the earth. Great, great verse of the Torah. But it says, Dnei Achicha. Your brother's bloods. Not your brother's bloods, but it's in the plural. Okay? The Mishnah says, Eino Omer Dam Achicha. It doesn't say the blood of your brother, Ela Dmei Achicha, but the bloods of your brother. Damo V'dam Zarotav, his blood and the blood of all of his progeny.
Is that where I get that concept?
All that concept comes from this Mishnah. Correct.
Dmei,
it comes. This Mishnah is the source of that idea that is then used in Jewish literature forever. Forever. The importance of any action where, God forbid, someone would lose his life, that it goes back to Cain. And Dmei Achicha. Okay. Goes on. Davar Acher. Another matter, another interpretation. Dmei Achicha, the bloods of your brother, and this is the more rational and less midrashic explanation, Shaya Damo Mushlach Ala Eitzim Va'ala Avanim, that Abel's blood was splattered all over the trees and over the rocks, and that's why it's in the plural. Now, of course, the commentators make clear that is simply the Mishnah doing its thing frequently, where you'll have an interpretation and then you have another interpretation, a Davar Acher. Not that this was said to the witnesses, because in a way this takes away from the terror that you are trying to inculcate in the witness if you go off on a tangent, because this is an effectively a tangent. So just keep that in mind, that though this is, you know, the way the Mishnah works, doesn't mean that this is in fact what was said. Okay? Now the Mishnah then goes on and continues. Lifichach. Now, this is in fact addressed to the witnesses. Lifichach nivra adam yechidi. Therefore was man created as one single human being. Lilamedcha. To teach you, Shekol Amabed Nefesh Achat MiYisrael, to teach you that whoever destroys a single life from Israel, Ma'ale Alav HaKatuv Ki'ilu Ibed Olam Male, the scripture itself weighs that person's actions as if he had destroyed an entire world. As if he had destroyed an entire world. V'chol mekayem nefesh achat miYisrael, and everybody who preserves one single life in Israel. Ma'ale alav akatuf, scripture values that, ki ilu kiyem olam male, as if a person has preserved an entire world. So here you see now, this is the same point, but it is based on a slightly different focus in the scripture. Again, it says, Lefichach nivra adam yechidi. Therefore was man created as one person. Now realize here that reference is being made to the creation story in chapter 2. Creation story in chapter 1 was that God decides to create human beings. Na'aseret ha'adam b'tzalmenu kidmurtenu. Zachar u'nekeva bara otam. Male and female he created them. So, contextually, it appears that there were two people at creation. Chapter 2, as it were, fleshes that out. Makes it very clear. Adam is created first, and then Eve is created from Adam. And you see that there is a moral reason for that. The moral reason is to make it quite clear that out of a single person comes a whole world. Every single person is so significant that the whole world comes out of every person. And that is the way the Torah says it. The Torah, therefore, has an extraordinary emphasis on the value of every single human being. You know, these are things that we have almost come to take for granted in our modern parlance, particularly in the Jewish community, that this is just the stuff. It all comes back to you. This is the Mishnah that is at the basis of this conception, and it is the Torah's conception. The Mishnah is quoting the Torah, and saying that is why the Torah begins with the story of a single person. Okay. Now it goes on. There are other reasons why the Mishnah says that a single person was created at the beginning. Shelo yomar adam l'chaveru abba gadol me'avicha. So that no person be able to say to any other person, my father was greater than your father. Extraordinary statement. Extraordinary statement. Because naturally we are dealing with all of humanity. And therefore we must relate to every human being as a fellow human being, and no particular person has claims greater than any other one. All human beings are sacred, as we say in our parlance. All human beings are sacred. Among the things that it is not saying is that all believers are sacred. All Jews are sacred. It says that all human beings are sacred. I've actually done research on this matter because it's a very interesting concept to me, the extent to which there is a belief in a unity of humanity. In a way, in the modern secular world, we take this for granted, and it's a result of Enlightenment thought. So I have thought to myself, to what extent does classical religion foster a notion of the unity of human beings? Okay? One of the unfortunate conclusions to which I've come is that I can't see that religion really does that, with the exception of this. Judaism does it. Judaism, frankly, is, I think, not entirely, but nearly unique in this conception. Generally speaking, what is usually the case, at least in the Western religions, I'm not thinking the Eastern religions, I really no particular comment. I can't bring that into the discussion. Simply, it's nothing that I am learned enough in. But in the Western religions, much has to do with faith, namely whether you are of the faith or not of the faith. And there is a different evaluation for those who are of the faith and not of the faith. For example, I just ran, in preparation for the class, I ran a search on the unity of humanity in Christianity. To my surprise, I got nothing, nothing worthwhile. I got no worthwhile reactions to that. Islam, of course, you kill for the faith. It's perfectly reasonable to kill as long as it's for the faith. Here you can see what the Mishnah has done. The Mishnah has a notion of humanity based on the Torah. It's based entirely on the Genesis story, on the story in Genesis. The only other religion that I found, which is a Western religion, where there is a central belief in humanity, is Baha'i. It's Baha'i. You know where the center of Baha'i is?
Haifa.
Haifa. Where is the Baha'i is buried? It came from Persia, but the founder is buried in Haifa. And Haifa is the center of the Baha'i religion. Not in Israel. Worldwide. I'll get to that in a minute. That's not the point that we're making here, which is based not on the, that's based on the story of Cain and Abel.
Right.
Right? Here we are back to the original human being. At this point in the discussion in the Mishnah, we've got another source, which is not the Cain and Abel story, but the fact that we all come from one human being. It's creation. The creation. Okay? I'll get back to what you just said because it's important.
Am I Unitarian?
Yes. Anything that's post-enlightenment. Unitarianism is a post-enlightenment form of Judaism. which is why if you go to your local Unitarian church, they also celebrate Rosh Hashanah, because where do the people come from? Correct. That's why I said it's a post-enlightenment form of Judaism. It is essentially, it is on the surface Christian, but it's an enlightenment form of Christianity. It's a type of Christianity that didn't exist before the Emancipation. Not the Emancipation, the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment. What I want you to note is that the Mishnah existed a lot before the Enlightenment. looking at something that is out of the Roman world. This is the end of the second century, what you are reading here. And that is its significance. And Baha'i, the Baha'i teaching, I'm reading to you now, the Baha'i teaching of the unity of humanity stems from the teaching that all humans have been created equal in the image of God, and that God does not make any distinction between people. Okay? With that, you could agree. That's essentially what the Torah says, and it's probably a combination of two things. Usually in Jewish ethics, the emphasis is placed on the creation of the human being, B'Tselem Elokim. In Jewish medical ethics, for example, it is the fact that a human being is created in the image of God that leads to the sacred nature of every human being. I don't entirely agree with that. It's partly true. But I think that there are really three issues here in the creation story in Genesis. One is the creation in the divine image. Two is the creation of a single human being. And three is called the Me'achicha. Okay? Three of them. Now, Herb correctly points out that the Mishnah says, call Ame'abed Nefesh Achad B'Yisrael. Everyone who destroys a single Jewish life. Okay? Nefesh echad mi Yisrael. So that you could well argue that this is something that we respect all Jews, but Jews, because it says Nefesh echad mi Yisrael. Two arguments against that. Or two and a half. First one is that, interestingly enough, in different manuscripts of the Mishnah, sometimes it appears as Yisrael, and sometimes that does not appear. So that obviously, even in our ancient sources, there are two different forms of that. The half, in addition to that, is that here you're addressing, in context now, you are addressing a witness who is in a Jewish court. And the truth is that that is your audience. You are dealing with an issue in a Jewish court. And you don't, the point is not to discuss humanity, but to discuss your responsibilities as a witness. Okay? And it doesn't have to be a more general idea. It's perfectly, in context, it makes perfectly reasonable sense. My third point, or my second and a half point is, I have 1.5 point so far, and that second one was 0.5 point. The third point is that the Mishnah goes on to amplify and to bring everything back to the initial creation of one human being. Okay? So that while the initial address to the witness makes reference to Cain and Abel, ultimately that is not the crucial issue for the unity of humanity. There the Mishnah makes it clear that so that a person cannot say, Avi gadol mi avicha, my father is greater than your father. Right? That is the key statement here. That is the key statement as far as a notion of humanity goes. The view of the Torah is that everything goes back to one human being. And that means that we are all brothers. We are all brothers. Brothers mean sisters as well, but this is no distinction. As far as the idea goes here, the idea is that all human beings go back to a single human being. Okay? Yes, sir.
Isn't the case for female and slaves?
It doesn't make any difference, yeah.
Doesn't make any difference?
No difference. It makes every human being, and it makes no difference. We're not talking, that becomes an issue. And the question is, that would create a problem with something like this, which is why if you study the Gemara, the laws of slavery, you'll see that for the Gemara doesn't know how to deal with slavery. I mean, because it's such a problem. It's got to be a problem. Eventually the Gemara says anybody who has a slave has got to be crazy. Anybody who has a slave has got to be crazy. Because the Gemara builds in a whole bunch of... Exactly. The Gemara builds in all kinds of responsibilities. Essentially you have to pay for, you have to give him medical insurance.
His kids, his wife,
everything is... So the Gemara finally concludes anybody who has a slave has got to be crazy. So it's not an anti-slavery tract. It doesn't exactly come from the 19th century. And it wasn't written by Abraham Lincoln or by an abolitionist. But obviously for the Gemara, slavery is a tremendous problem. Okay. Yes, sir.
If you have this universality of individuals, everybody in God's image, everybody from the same Father, everybody enjoying God's blessing, why bother to be Jewish?
Because that's a very good question. The answer is because the Jews have a covenant with God which is peculiar to them. It in no way diminishes I honestly don't think that it has to concern anybody else. Your own history is your history, who you are and what you are called to be. But I don't see why that has to reflect at all on anybody else, not even that you should be an example to somebody else, because maybe you shouldn't be. Why should you be an example? I did a paper once. I gave a paper to the National Council of Catholic Bishops. I got to get this paper published because eventually it was censored by Jews. It was censored by Jews, and that's why it wasn't published. And it was one of the last breaths that what was called the National Council of Synagogues. It used to be an organization called the National Council of Synagogues. And it had Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox synagogues. As you could imagine, that was not long for this world. And it wasn't long. It died right after that paper, as a matter of fact. It didn't last much beyond that. So they asked me to give a paper on roughly this subject, on the image of Jews and universality. Good subject, very good subject. The ones who have been most interested in that subject are Catholics. I get another paper at Fordham University on that subject. That's been published. That's somewhere here in the library. So a book that was published by Fordham. On the notion of universality. And to me, it's a crucial idea. It's a very, very important idea. And in the first paper, the one that I gave to the Catholic bishops and the late Jewish council, there I quoted from Isaiah. I think this is what upset the Jews. It didn't upset the Catholics, but it upset the Jews. Where we know that the Jews, Isaiah says that we are to be a light unto the nations. You know what I said? That he never said it. He never said it. He never said it. And I brought the source, and I showed that Isaiah never said that you shall be a light unto the nations. Did you believe that? He never said it.
Who said it?
Maskilim said it. Okay? Jews who are dealing with the issues of emancipation created a notion which is related to what Isaiah said, but it is not what he said. It is not what he said. Look at it carefully. Well, you've got to look at it carefully. Is it in English?
Or
Lager, you find that for me in Isaiah. You find it for me. Okay? You find it in context. How do I know this? Moshe Greenberg. You know Moshe, Professor Moshe Greenberg at the Hebrew University wrote a paper on this, which was published in Conservative Judaism a number of years ago when they used to publish good papers. He wrote a wonderful, wonderful paper on the misconceptions that we have of what Isaiah actually said, because Isaiah was used by post-emancipation Jews to create a theology of who the Jews are in the modern world. Okay? And it's actually a little bit, it's not vastly different, but it's significantly different.
Well, Rabbi Mordechai Kaplan,
go ahead.
I don't know if he went back to
Well, Kaplan was more extreme than I'm being here, because Kaplan was upset about the notion of chosenness. I don't get upset by that at all. I think it's great. I think it's wonderful Jews. I think every child should feel chosen by a parent. You know, that you matter more to your parent than anybody else, including your brother and your sister. And what does your brother and your sister think? Exactly the same thing. Exactly the same. The way to bring up children is not that one person thinks it or that nobody thinks it, but that everybody thinks it. Everybody thinks it. And then that's the problem of being a child. You know, it's a problem of sibling relations. How do you relate to the other one who's not as chosen as you are? And each of us has exactly the same problem. Well, we should have that problem, okay? So I never agreed with Kaplan there, although I had a conversation today with a book coming out now by Indiana University Press, Professor Mel Skult. You know, Mel Scott, he had him speak here after we opened this building. Had him speak here on a Friday night. He was in. He was writing a paper. He had written a paper. He was about to publish a paper on Solomon Schechter. Solomon Schechter, which was very important. It was very good because I'm one of the big believers, although it was done this last year, about a year and a half ago. Schechter is one of the great, great Jews of the 20th century. And especially in the conservative movement, nobody knows about him except for the name on the wall. But people have never read Schechter. Schechter's an extraordinary scholar, extraordinary Jew, one of the most interesting and deep Jews who lived in the 20th century. And the great book was written about Schechter, was published last year. I had the people on the radio program. What was it called? Some of you, I recommended it to everybody. What was it called?
Sacred Trash.
Sacred Trash. That's what it was. Sacred Trash. Absolutely wonderful book. It's referring to the Ganesa. It's
on, I have it on Amazon.
Sacred Trash is just a beautifully written book. Go read it. You read it, Alan. Remember you read it? We were talking about it. It's just beautiful. And it's about Schechter. Schechter, how wonderful he is. So, Mel Skolt is he published Kaplan's Diaries, and he told me today that he is just about to publish a complete biography of Kaplan. God bless Mel Skolt. He's terrific. He is a great scholar. He has done wonderful work in Kaplan, and that's going to come out in the next weeks, he said. It's coming out. Indiana University is publishing this book. But for Kaplan, chosenness was a problem. When any of the Kaplanians are called to our Torah, downstairs, we have this, some of you know, you come to the Minyan in the morning. We have some people who will come to the Minyan, call them to the Torah, and they will not say, Shabbachabanu mikola amim. Okay? Shabbachabanu is bracha for the Torah, because it says, He who chose us from amongst all the people. Instead they say, Asher karvanu la'avodato, He who has drawn us near to His worship. Okay, because it was an issue for them. Getting back to our text here, though, the text is a text that is focused, I think, on the universality of all of humanity. And the belief that all of humanity is a universal community. And the Jews then are come to be, only much later on in the Torah, a community that has a certain path that it is required to take. Okay? It has a path that is required to take. In the language of the Torah, it has a covenant. It has a covenant with God. Now, to what extent that covenant can or should be understood by other nations to be something that they should be accepting, that's another question. That's another question. It's an interesting question. It's a question in the history of the Western world. It's a question in the history of Christianity. To what extent is this covenant a covenant that in any way is a covenant that other people should accept. We have our own view about that. We have a notion of Sheva Mitzvot Penei Noach, seven Noahide laws. So we have an idea that there is a universal, there are universal, essentially ethical ideas that in fact should apply to all of humanity. Much of what you have in the Torah is not that, however. It is the peculiar legislation that applies only to the Jews.
Universality that we're talking of implies that every human being has a certain sanctity. It doesn't necessarily imply that every human being or every class of human beings is equal. Mm-hmm. Jews have a place in the world to come, maybe not necessarily in the same fashion that others do. Jews are
chosen to do certain things as a people, but the fact that we might be chosen, or the fact that Judaism invests us with certain qualities, doesn't imply that we can abuse other human beings by virtue of that. But I think in some other religions, at least, there's a sense among some that that other classes of human beings are lesser in some extent, and gives them some right to abuse.
Well, the way I introduced it was that we have a religion, for example, which provides dignity based on faith. Then, if you're of the faith, you have certain status or dignity or rights. And if you're not, you're on the outside. That level of dignity doesn't adhere to you. I think that's along the lines of what you're arguing here, and I would say that's definitely true. Definitely true. The others? Yes? That's interesting. In fact, that's not true.
Oh, okay.
It's not true.
So that's not why it's here?
No. It is here in order to terrify the witness, who is, for whatever reason, a witness who's a valid witness. Okay? To terrify the witness in terms of the significance of the death penalty that may result.
It's the value of the...
So it's the value of the accused. It is really to underline the value of the accused, whoever that accused is. That's it. And everyone there, that accused could be slave, could be free, could be male, could be female, could be anybody. Okay? Probably it could not be a minor, but otherwise it could be anybody.
The witness of value is somebody who has seen facts.
Correct. Correct.
He cannot report anything that was a rumor or told by somebody else.
You mean in our legal system?
Certain precise facts.
Correct.
He cannot go on the circumstantial evidence.
That is essential to this. Yes. One, two, three. Okay.
If the court finds the defendant guilty, puts him to death.
Okay, the mission is going to get to that. The mission will get to that. You're feeling where it's going.
So it's inherently it's almost like a double standard for the way a witness has to behave as opposed to the way the judge is to behave. Their standard of who is valued more or less doesn't conform to this.
What do you mean?
Well, didn't you just say, unless I misunderstood, that this is to instill fear in the witness, the idea that all people are of an equal stature. But it's not what governs the behavior of the judges.
What do you mean by that?
In their decision-making about who's guilty and who isn't, or who should be punished and who shouldn't.
Well, the judge... Let's clarify here. The judge will be very dependent on the witness, on the testimony of the witness, not the witness, but the witness's testimony. And then every effort will be made to disqualify the witness's testimony, to show that it's not valid testimony. And then the judge will be required to make a decision, or judges, because it's a court of 23, will be required to make a decision based on the testimony and nothing but the testimony. So that's the procedure.
Okay, but the people who are coming before the court are not necessarily Jews, are they?
That's an interesting question. I think here the assumption is that they are. Whether they must be or not is another question. Here, in this Mishnah, I think the assumption is that they are.
If they weren't, then they certainly would not have any stature in the judges. Correct or not?
Yes, it's not clear. just so it's not clear, because again, it's not the person, but it is the testimony. It's the testimony that is crucial here. And the testimony is what will either rise or fall. Okay? And keep in mind another thing. One of the results of where we're going so far is going to make it very hard to actually get the witnesses to testify. Your reaction, Dick, was, you know, what do I need this for? You know, after all of this, you're going to terrorize the witnesses. It's a very easy way to deal with that. Walk away. Walk away. It's too much of a burden to put on people. It really is too much of a burden to put on people. So that part of what you see happening here is creating a situation which makes it really quite difficult to prosecute this case. You're creating impediments to the prosecution of the case.
No powers of subpoena for a witness?
Oh, they're supposed to kill him immediately.
Well, you'll see. I'll hold off on that because no, we're talking about the witnesses. Talking about the witnesses, you'll see that the Mishnah will refer some along the lines to something along the lines of what you're saying.
Rabbi?
Yes. You're right.
I don't understand this concept of circumstantial evidence. I saw the defendant's retinum. I saw him sharpen his knife. I saw him the next day cleaning the knife the blood off and washing the blood off of his hands. That's all arguably circumstantial. And it's all arguably circumstantial. The only thing he didn't see was the act. You can't convict of that.
Can't convict. It's now. This is the Gemara is going to say nearly word for word what you just said. Creates a theoretical case which is just about what you just said, and it says, "How could you say that? Ridiculous!" I mean, a guy comes and he says, "I saw you go in there, and I saw two of you go in, and then I saw that your hands were filled with blood, and I saw that you were holding the knife. And what do you think? Was it me who killed him? What could it be?" Can't commit. Cannot commit. Now, as soon as I say that, it just goes so against what we think, what seems so intuitively obvious, that you say to yourself, they must have another agenda. And I am saying to you, I think implicitly there is another agenda here, because it's simply not reasonable. The other agenda has got to be to simply make it impossible to convict in a capital case, because the end result is that you're going to take away a life. And because of that result, you're going to see every effort made to make it impossible to achieve that.
Like owning a slave.
Yeah.
Instead of changing the punishment.
You can't do that. You know why you can't do it? Because the
Torah
says it. Right? Right? If the Torah says that for this particular crime, you are to receive the death penalty, that's it. That's it. So the only thing you can do is say, well, I guess we just can't convict the person. Okay? You have a different method. But you're motivated to a great extent by the theology that is implicit here that comes from Genesis. Because of the theology of Genesis and the value of the human life, in a way, that argues against what the law itself tells you to do. Okay, so there's an implicit tension in the law. And it's not a tension that's a simple tension, but it's always going to be there. It's always going to be there.
Contemporary Israel?
Essentially, more or less, the answer is no, because they read the Mishnah. And the state of Israel only has had one person who got the death penalty. And that was a unique circumstance. You know who that person was?
Eichmann.
Adolf Eichmann.
It was a special court.
It was a special case, and
Israel does not have
a death penalty. And it keeps coming up as an issue because terrorists do not get the death penalty. And as soon as they're in jail, that's all the motivation for someone to free them from jail. You know, so it's constantly an issue, but because of this Mishnah, the state of Israel does not have a death penalty.
What basis do they form that special court?
Excuse me?
What basis do they form that special court?
It was, the Holocaust is considered 6.5 it had to do with the 6 million people. That it had to do with the Holocaust and dealing with a unique situation. Okay?
And another question of universality. I think Christianity and Islam, theological terms, are usually referred to as universalistic religions, meaning one true religion. They have an obligation to bring that
to everyone. Correct.
One true religion. Judaism is in a separate category, generally.
Yes, let me
but
make...
I think that it's in the nature of religion to believe in one true revealed word of God. And in that sense, you talk about Muslims and Christians permitted to kill in the name of their religion, crusades, that's what I'm asking here, although it's not directly related. In the section that's derived from creation, Adam Yechidi, where it refers to
Yivrad
of Israel, I'm wondering, because there is a political implication here, maybe this was still in the time when the idea of active armed revolt against Rome was a reality, and in a world where taking another human life is forbidden under any circumstance, it's difficult to justify armed revolt even against an oppressor. So I'm wondering whether there was some political element here as well.
There are those who might say yes, and there are those who might say no. I think when you get down to these subjects, there's no doubt that there are differences of opinion about them. We shouldn't think that the idea of a war for this, that war itself, all war even for the sake of conquest, is not from the Jewish Bible. It is. It's in the Torah. It's very basic to the Torah that you are commanded to exterminate the Canaanites. So that is certainly in the Torah. So we're not outside of that. By the way, it's a wonderful paper. Last year's Society of Biblical Literature meeting, it was a session devoted to the thought of Professor from Leviticus,
Milgram.
Professor Milgram. It was a memory of Milgram. A woman gave a paper on the notion of cherem among the Hittites and the idea of the hachrim, which can mean to annihilate or it can mean to extirpate or it can mean something else, but it has to do with the problems of something that is sacred that becomes unsacred. That is an issue of the Torah. Not only was it of the Torah, but she showed how this is a basic issue in the Hittites. It is an issue in that part of the world having to do with the nature of sacred space. Sacred space. And it can be a country as sacred space, it can be a neighborhood as sacred space, and all of that is common to the people of the ancient Near East. Someday this paper will get published, and it will be important to read. Yes?
What the court will do if there are no witnesses, and the defendant come and say, I killed him?
They have to say, well, you'll see what happens. They cannot convict him of a capital crime.
So there is the whole issue, is it void, it's null?
It's a problem. It's potentially a problem. There are two ways to deal with that. One is to find the witnesses. And of course, one witness is not enough.
You need two witnesses.
Because one witness could either be mistaken in what he saw. You need corroboration. You need two witnesses to corroborate.
We had this here with Eitan's school kid.
Eitan Patz?
Yeah.
Yes.
Patz?
Yeah,
that's the man who said he did it.
What?
Then the man who said he did it. We were just talking
about it. The man said he did it, but we don't know he did it. We haven't
yeah, but we also have people admit to doing things they don't.
That's exactly
right.
That's exactly right. We have in our system, we know in these cases where you would think that rational people would never admit to a case for which they could get the death penalty. That's not true. It happens all the time. And we have...
They're not independent operators at that point. If they're not doing it, many of them aren't doing it.
No, there's something wrong with them.
No, the context is under pressure.
Well, one way is under pressure.
Yeah, right.
But there are also people who
want
the publicity. They want the notoriety. They just... all kinds of people in this world. All kinds of people. And, in fact, this other issue, you're bringing up another issue, which is the admissibility of a confession. We haven't reached that subject here. But in fact, a confession is not admissible in a Jewish court. Confession is not admissible. Which is why you always need external witnesses. Any of you who got married, I hope that some of you remember that. When you got married, you had a ketubah. Ketubah for your wedding. I was the rabbi at your wedding, you have a ketubah at a wedding, and the question is, the bride and the groom, do they sign the ketubah? Okay? They may, if you have an English part of the ketubah, we have the bride and the groom do it in English. But the ketubah itself, the bride and the groom don't sign. Why? Because it's a contract, and an individual, his testimony is not admissible in a court about his own concerns. So it has to be independent witnesses. That's why bride and groom don't sign the ketubah.
Jay made the observation, and I think it's worth bringing into the community. In a society that's unwilling to convict where a crime fully establishes our crime, is there a tremendous amount of blood feud? Is that how society deals with those who do kill? Mm-hmm. That plans take on the responsibility.
That's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. And we know how true that is because we know it from contemporary times in reading about Afghanistan and Pakistan and the legacy there. And we know about it from other societies, Syria.
Just depending on the situation.
Is that the underlying premise here of how society does take care of?
Good question. I think the answer is no. No, and you can see the way the Torah itself creates a situation to fight against that. You know what that is? The city of refuge. In Deuteronomy, the discussion of the city of refuge is exactly there to fight against that notion of the clan who comes and does the dirty work itself.
No, but if he was caught on the way, they're allowed to kill him. If they caught him on the way, they're allowed to kill him.
Not saying they're allowed, but allowed to kill him means...
they will do it.
If they do it, you cannot bring a case against them.
Correct.
Now, it doesn't mean that they have free license to do it. There's a difference between the two. It means that if they do it, then you can't bring a case against them. Okay? But, therefore... you have the city. Correct. You got to get there first in order to protect yourself. But the idea here is that one of the functions of the law, and I made this comment last week at the SBL, as a matter of fact. Let me think of the context. This was a woman delivered a paper about levirate marriage. levirate marriage. This is a case of Yehudan Tamar. Trying to think of what her point was. I remember what my point was. I'll tell you what my point was. Forget about what she said. That was a good point. I said to her that Professor Kass, Leon Kass, of the University of Chicago, Leon Kass is professor of philosophy at the University of Chicago. He published a book called The Wisdom of the Torah, I think it is. Biblical Wisdom or something like that. Leon Kass, a wonderful philosopher. Really. He gave the Lucy Davidovich lecture a few years ago. And that was on a controversial topic, but on the Torah he's not so controversial. He's really just plain good. He was at the time the head of the Presidential Commission on Medical Ethics. That's why when he would say things, they were in those days particularly controversial. It was Leon Kass. So Leon Kass wrote his book on Genesis. It's a wonderful book if you want to read a good book on the philosophy of Genesis.
K-A-S-S.
He says that the incidents of Genesis are pre the institution of the law as a functioning legal system. And therefore, one of the ways to understand what happens in Genesis is that Genesis really illustrates a world that functions without law. And the law is rather taken into the hands of small groups. Okay? So that, for example, here, remember, now that I told you what my point was, I remember what her point was. So her point was that Yehuda had the right to, he says, that she shall be burned, Tamar, before he realizes that it's his daughter-in-law. It's reported to him that she's pregnant. He says, take her out to be burned. Okay? So there the question is, how could he say, take her out to be burned? What right does he have to make a statement like that? Or what does it mean within the Torah? So she writes, you know, that maybe, maybe it means that he has the right to bring her to a corpse. Let's say. Maybe that's what it means. It doesn't mean that he necessarily has the right to do it himself. Or here the idea was that perhaps a man has a right to do it to a woman, or that a man, since he has some rights over her because she was the daughter-in-law, does that have put her into a subservient position? So I said, well, whatever it is, what do you think about what Kass said? Which is that that's not unusual for the Torah. I mean, it may be one thing, maybe another, but take, for example, I gave the example in the lecture of the case of Shimon and Levi and Shechem. You remember the story of Shechem? Shechem sleeps with Dinah, their sister, and they say, okay, all right. You know, they say to each other, how could he have done that? This is a terrible thing. So they go to Shechem. They say to him, look, we'll let you marry our sister if you all get circumcised. So they all get circumcised. And Shimon and Levi, right after their circumcision, Shimon and Levi come, they kill them all. Terrible, it's a great story. It's a wonderful Torah story. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, you go and you rape a lady. What do you expect? You know, it's a very primitive reaction to rape. But it's you know, that's what you gotta take. You take your life in your hands if you're gonna do something like that. You get what you deserve. It's very primitive. And I'm not saying that this is not primitive. It's very primitive. So I say this in a lecture. I said to this lady who gave a lecture, I said, this is not basically a good idea to run a society like that, do you think? Said, of course not. So I said, well, that's the whole purpose of the Torah. The book of Genesis is pre-legislation. This is Leon Kess's point. That the book of Genesis, when we see these rather primitive things, part of the way in which the narrative is built is to have the readers say, oh my God, look what they did. How could they do stuff like this? Because ultimately you're leading to the Mosaic legislation. And the Mosaic legislation is for the Jews the ultimate civilizing legislation. Okay? All of this is the ultimate result of the Mosaic legislation. But that's the point. The point is that the narrative is created in such a way so that you feel the need for it. You, the reader, feel the sense of ethical outrage at some of the things that even your heroes are doing. Okay? Now, a lot of people don't like that idea because their heroes are always supposed to have done the right thing. Okay? That's a classic Jewish reaction that nothing, you know, our heroes never could have done anything that was less than what Tzaddikim did. But I think Leon Kess is absolutely right. What Kess is arguing here is that that's the way in which the narrative is structured in order to lead us in a certain direction, in a way it shows the problematics of a community that exists without a solid system of legislation and courts.
Yeah, but they made a deal with Marat Maskela, which was legally documented, so there were the laws at that time.
There apparently were some, but they were insufficient. You needed the Mosaic legislation. Right? All of this leads to Exodus, and we are growing out of that legislation. What we are reading here is the product of that. It's a product of a long period of time, naturally. But that's crucial for the growth of the community.
I think Shimon Levy stole the idols from
Shimon. No, it was...
There was another part of it.
The stealing of the idols was... It was Rachel. It was Rachel.
I think they also took the idols from Shem.
The Torah doesn't say it, but... You remember what Jacob then says? Ushatak v'shamarat adavar. Right? He was silent, and he kept the thing inside. And he said, you know, how could you do stuff like this? What are they going to do to us? But that all is the reality where there is no law. There is no law because what are they going to do to us? We've got to get along with our neighbors. We can't do stuff like that. That's not a universal statement that he makes. Not that it was wrong. But what are they going to do to us? That's a different equation. Okay?
Make it this difficult to commit, it seems it must, as the saying goes, it'd be awfully easy to get away with murder. And I said, well, maybe the disincentive is, you know, whoever thinks you did it will then do it to you, and they feel they can get away with it. How do they control the incidence of murder? I would think it's pretty easy to kill someone, not have two witnesses.
So the Gemara and Makot says exactly that. One point of view is, I remember, one is Rabbi Shimon, the other is Rabbi Yossi. I don't remember which is which. One says, all of this is in order to control the murderous instinct in a few human beings. And the other one says, how could you ever do that? Because every human being is sacred. And how do you know, really, that this is what a person deserves? And you know the ramifications of that. Psychologically, how do you know? How do you know the causes? How do you know the issues? It's a problem. There's no solution for that problem. It's a problem that is still with us to this day. We live on that fine, we walk that fine line.
Most places in the world don't have the death penalty. And they get along somehow.
Mm-hmm. We don't know here exactly what was going on. We're talking about capital punishment. And then if I show it here, right?
Right.
So we don't know what they did short of capital punishment.
Mm-hmm. Well, we do know what they did. I mean, there were other types of penalties. There was flogging, you know. So you did have penalties like that, but realize that you have another penalty here. When you're dealing with a divine system, there is human retribution, and there is divine. So that there is another possibility. And we'll be getting to that, so don't worry, it'll come up. All right, I'm sorry.
We're talking during Roman periods. If someone, say, committed murder and the Jewish courts would not convict,
mm-hmm.
but wouldn't the Romans intercede if a case like
it's
that?
It's a very interesting point that you make, because it's not clear. It's really not clear. It's not clear the extent to which what we are reading here is sort of philosophizing in a world where these ideas had no practical ramifications. Because it could be that only the Romans had the political power to be able to convict in a capital case. Could be. It's not really clear. It appears from the context that the rabbis are dealing with a real cases. But maybe they weren't. We really don't know.
Well, you know, in the ancient world in general, and I imagine in the Jewish world as well, what they didn't have that we have are penal systems. The ancient world really didn't believe in prison. So
correct. They did not have a penal system. That's correct.
You were either executed or exiled or, you know, flogged. And that was it. But, you know, we solved the problems by just taking people and putting them away.
Or make them a slave.
A slave.
A slave.
Yeah.
They did have
Yeah, but it's not the same as a penal system. It's not the same as prison. Prison is sort of a catch-all. I worked for a while with somebody whose wife works on Rikers Island. It's just, it has a life of its own, the penal system. You know, it is what it is, as any of these forms of punishment essentially do. Let's go a little bit further. We still have a few minutes, because we have gone into a great deal of depth about the phrase, Shelo yomar adam lachavero abba gadol miavicha. No person should ever say to his fellow, my father is greater than your father. All of that was because man was created as a single human being. The Gemara also has another reason, another theological ramification of the single human being that was created. Shelo yuhu aminim omrim aberu shiyopya shamayim. So that the heretics not have cause to say, there are, in effect, many gods in the heavens. That is to say, if you have one creation, there's a unity to all of the creation, right? There's simply one human being that's created, and that appears to argue for the oneness of the Creator, the oneness of the Creator. I think the force of that argument is not absolutely obvious, but I'll just refer you to Plato, for example. In Plato, in the Timaeus, Plato believes in a creator god. But he really has a problem with that creation, and that is that the purity of a pure god is such that the pure god can only create pure things. Right? Because all is perfect, and the perfect God should create a perfect creation. And Plato acknowledges the fact that the creation is not perfect. So how do you solve that problem? With two creators. Right? The first creator was a perfect creator. The second creator was called a demiurgos. The demiurgos was a creator who did the dirty work. Right? Didn't create a perfect creation, created an imperfect creation, which is the natural world that we know, which is imperfect. Okay? So even there you see, it was natural in Plato to assume, once he tried to figure out what the nature of God was from the creation, that you had two gods because of the imperfect nature of the creation. Okay? Here, the Mishnah says it in a slightly different way, that when you have one human being created, if you had two human beings created, then that would have been a very good beginning to say that there were two creators. Okay? We can't say that, because there's only one. Okay? In order to speak the praises, the greatness of the Holy One, blessed be He. For when a human being mints many coins from one mold, Kulan domin zelaze, all the coins look the same. Umelach malcheim lachim akadosh baruch hu, the King of King of Kings, the Holy One, blessed be He. Tava kol adam bechotamo shel adam rishon. He minted every human being from the first person. Ve'ein echad domeh lechavero, and no person is like the other. It's really an extraordinary statement here, that this is the praise of God. The fact that there is such variety in humanity, usually we think of as a problem. Everybody, if everybody were like me, there would be no problems in the world. There would be no problems, okay? But the amazing thing about the creation of God is that everybody is different. Everybody is that you walk along the street. Thank, I said to somebody, it was in Chicago. This convention I went to was in Chicago. So, Chicago, it's a big city like New York. It's not like New York, but it's sort of like New York. And everybody is different. So many different groups of people. So one of the people who had come from a small town, teaching university in a small town, says. He says, you know, you don't realize. You're taking difference for granted. I said, why? He says, you come from New York. I said, well, what do you mean? He said, where I come from, everybody looks alike. I said, what do you mean? He says, they're all German Lutherans. They all came from northern Germany to Minnesota, wherever he was, somewhere in the Midwest. And he says, all the people, they look alike. They look like they're related to each other. They look like fair lady. He says, in New York, you don't think about that. He says, but where I live, he says, I'm the only one that looks different. I'm Jewish. He says, everybody else is alike. And he says, we who are different, we really feel different because we look different. We look different from everybody else. With those of us who live in the large cities, we know that God creates everybody different. Everybody is different. And that is the greatness of God. Heschel said this once. I don't know how many of you ever remember. There was a wonderful issue, a wonderful television program. It was an interviewer for NBC, Carl. You remember this? Carl. He was very dry. Forget his last name. Carl. His first name was Carl. He interviews Abraham Joshua Heschel. So he says to Heschel, he says, Dr. Heschel, why is it that there's so much variety in the world? Why didn't God ever make everybody beautiful? Why didn't God ever make everybody good? So he says, you don't understand the way God works. The greatness of God is that He made everybody free and different. He says, but that's, you know, a world is a big mess because of that. Heschel says, you don't understand. That's the greatness and the glory of God. If a human being were to make a mold, everyone would come out the same, which you just read here. But when the Holy One, blessed be He, makes the mold, some are black and some are white and some are yellow and some are red and some are tall and some are short and some are fat and some are thin and some are beautiful and some are not as beautiful. He said, that is the world that God made for us. To be continued.
This is really good. I brought you the DVD. I promised that there's absolutely no pressure to see it.
Oh boy,
no pressure at all. I won't ask if you watched or anything. I just brought it so you could have it.
Oh, I look forward to it.
It's an ongoing project.
Okay, good for you.
This was really wonderful, and this was I'm so glad I came today, especially because of the question I asked you about the second line in the Leno. It's just such a